Okay, so I'm Rick Hansen, and this is August 4th, 2011, and 2010. See, time, you know. She didn't realize she wasn't here. She lost a week. I lost a year. Crazy stuff. All right. Anyway, that's good. So anyway, I want to talk tonight about the desires that get us in trouble. And the context for this is this larger inquiry we've been doing into mindfulness, being mindful of things in general, and working with, in particular, the Buddhist structure for where we apply mindfulness. What are we mindful of? So we spent a lot of time in the first part of this year focusing on the body and body sensations and exploring mindfulness of the body, which is a major area of methods for the Buddha. And then we've begun focusing now on the second application or foundation of mindfulness, which is the feeling tone of experience, moment to moment, as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, which is very important because it's in response to that ongoing signal, or what's called in psychology in the West, the affective valence, the emotional valence, the hedonic valence of experiences. It's based on that valence that we tend to pursue what's pleasant, resist or recoil from what's unpleasant, or when something is neutral, to kind of not even notice it at all, or to brush it aside so it gets pleasant again, right? And thus suffering begins. So studying what the mind does in reaction moment to moment to pleasant or unpleasant or neutral is a very great way to bring practice into the here and now, and creating over time a kind of shock absorber around pleasant or unpleasant, so that we're not captured or programmed or triggered by pleasant or unpleasant alone, but instead buy ourselves some time via our shock absorber to bring wisdom to bear and mindfulness to bear. And then we allow ourselves to be moved towards some things that are pleasant, that are wholesome, and away from other things that are unpleasant and unwholesome. For example, it's healthy to respond to some of the feeling tones. For example, the pleasure that comes from good company, or the pleasure that comes from generosity, or the sacred, or paying attention to what we appreciate or are grateful for. Those are wholesome, pleasant sensations to be moved toward and to increasingly give ourselves over to, right? To surrender increasingly to, and to have our lives be increasingly animated by those pleasures. And on the other hand, it's wholesome to pull our hand back from the unpleasant feeling tone of a hot stove, right? Or to recoil at the thought of doing something harmful to someone we really care about. Or, for example, to use your example, to pull back from the unpleasant feeling tone, really, of gossiping. In the ways in particular that it's a departure from gratitude, for example. It's okay. In other words, it's not that we should never respond to feeling tones. The trick is to respond with wisdom so that we don't create suffering and harm for ourselves and for other people, and instead create happiness and benefit for ourselves and other people. So that's the larger structure here. And to that point, I'd like to offer a bit of a view myself about two kinds of Buddhism, and more broadly, really, two kinds of spiritual practice. And the dichotomy, the distinction I'm making here between these two sorts of Buddhism, sorts of spiritual practice, is artificial. There's more of a continuum here, but I think you'll know what I'm talking about. So, as someone who's really appreciated the movement of Buddhism into the West and into America in particular over the last 50 years, particularly what's called convert Buddhism. In other words, Buddhism has been in America with the immigrants that arrived here from Asia for well over 100 years. And often that aspect of Buddhism gets improperly overlooked in the magazines and so forth that are created for what's more called convert Buddhism, which typically are people here who are already in America, more often than not Caucasian, who've gotten interested in Zen or Theravadan / Vipassana Buddhism or Tibetan Buddhism. But in any case, in particular with the Buddhism that I know of, which is more convert Buddhism, you know, Zen, Tibetan, and Theravadan, you know, my own experience of a lot of it is what I will call, and, you know, I acknowledge the pejorative tone, Buddhism light. Buddhism light. Buddhism that's about being nicer and calmer. And that's kind of the gist of it. Right? And I think you can bring to mind teachings and maybe some of my own that really boil down to being nicer and calmer. Now, consider the alternative, being meaner and more rattled. Well, nicer and calmer is an improvement, right? And yeah, and in the Dharma, even in terms of what the Buddha himself taught, he did talk. He did have teachings about simply being nicer and teachings about simply being calmer. There's a place for that, all right? There really is a place for that. In addition to that, and sometimes laid on top of that as a foundation, there's another kind of Buddhism altogether that is a radical invitation to complete freedom from suffering and its causes. That's really more profound, more unconditional, more all-pervading, and more committing than simply being nicer and calmer. And I want to read to you, if I could, sections from a fairly well-known sutta called the Heartwood Sutta. And the language here is traditional. I'll edit it slightly on the fly. And this sutta here clearly speaks to the upper limits, really, of the possibility that the Buddha laid out, including based on his own direct experience of the possibility available to each one of us. So it says, the Blessed One, the Buddha, addressed everyone in this way. People, here someone goes forth out of faith from the household life into homelessness, which is to say, you know, becomes a monastic, although it doesn't just apply to monastics here. And this person considers, I am a victim of birth, aging, and death, of sorrow, lamentation, pain, dejection, and despair. I am a victim of suffering, prey to suffering. Surely an ending of this whole mass of suffering can be known. And then when this person does some practices, he or she acquires gain, honor, and renown. And the person is pleased with that gain, honor, and renown, and his or her intention is fulfilled. And on account of that, he or she becomes intoxicated with that gain, honor, and renown, grows negligent, falls into negligence, and being negligent, lives in suffering. Then here comes the famous metaphor. Suppose a person needing heartwood, which is the core, the strongest part of a tree, the inner core. Suppose a person needing heartwood, seeking heartwood, wandering in search of heartwood, came to a great tree standing possessed of heartwood. Passing over its heartwood, its sapwood, its inner bark, and its outer bark, suppose this person would cut off its twigs and leaves and take them away, thinking they were heartwood. Then a person with good sight, seeing all this, might say, this other person did not know the heartwood, the sapwood, the inner bark, the outer bark, or the twigs and leaves. Thus, while needing heartwood, seeking heartwood, wandering in search of heartwood, this person came to a great tree standing possessed of heartwood, and passing over its heartwood, its sapwood, its inner bark, and its outer bark, he or she cut off its twigs and leaves and took them away thinking they were heartwood. Whatever it was that this good man or woman had to make with heartwood, that purpose will not be served. So too it is with this practitioner, this spiritual practitioner who becomes intoxicated with simply gain, honor, and renown. This monk or person is called one who has taken the twigs and leaves of the spiritual life and stopped short with that. And then with some repetition of language, which I won't do here in the interest of time, there are further levels of attainment, which I'll list to you. Then again, take the case of a different person who goes, who does spiritual practice and acquires gain, honor, and renown, but is not pleased with that gain, honor, and renown, and his or her intention is not yet fulfilled. That person does not, on account of gain, honor, and renown, disparage others, praise oneself, or become intoxicated, or fall into negligence. Being diligent, this spiritual practitioner achieves the attainment of moral discipline. This person is pleased with that attainment of moral discipline, and his or her intention is fulfilled. And becoming intoxicated with that attainment of moral discipline, grows negligent, falls into negligence, and being negligent, lives in suffering. And then suppose a person needing heartwood, and then pursues the example, passing over its heartwood, its sapwood, and its inner bark, this person cuts off his outer bark and takes it away, thinking it is heartwood. So too it is with this sort of a person who becomes intoxicated with the attainment of moral discipline. That person is called one who has taken the outer bark of the spiritual life and stopped short with that. Then to go to the next step, suppose there is another person who acquires gain, honor, and renown from spiritual practice and keeps going and achieves the attainment of moral discipline and keeps going and then achieves the attainment of concentration but simply becomes pleased with only that. And that person becomes intoxicated with that attainment of concentration, grows negligent, falls into negligence, and being negligent, lives in suffering. In much the same way, this would be like a person who, passing over the tree's heartwood and sapwood, cuts off its inner bark, thinking that it's heartwood. And those who know that person would say, this is a person who has taken the inner bark of the spiritual life and stopped short with that. Then imagine another person who does gain honor and renown, and keeps going, and being diligent achieves the attainment of moral discipline, and keeps going, and achieves the attainment of concentration, and keeps going, and achieves knowledge and vision. This is subtle clarity, subtle spiritual powers even, and then is pleased with that and stops there, and becomes intoxicated with that knowledge and vision, etc., becomes negligent and lives in suffering. So too with regard to the tree, passing over its heartwood, such a person has cut off its sapwood and taken it away thinking it was heartwood. This person is called one who has taken the sapwood of the spiritual life and stopped short with that. And then imagine the last person. This is a person who goes forth and practices and acquires gain, honor, and renown and is not satisfied with just that and keeps going. And then that person achieves the attainment of moral discipline and keeps going and achieves the attainment of concentration and keeps going. And by being diligent, achieves knowledge and vision. This person is pleased with that knowledge and vision, but his or her intention is not yet fully fulfilled. And based on that, this person does not laud him or herself and disparage others, or become intoxicated with that knowledge and vision, does not grow negligent and fall into negligence. Being diligent and continuing, this person attains perpetual emancipation. And for such a person, it is impossible to fall away from that perpetual liberation. And in this case, it's as if it was a person needing heartwood, seeking heartwood, wandering in search of heartwood, came to a great tree standing possessed of heartwood, and cutting off only its heartwood, would take it away, knowing it was heartwood. Then a person with good sight, seeing this, would say, "This good man or woman knew the heartwood, the sapwood, the inner bark, the outer bark, and the twigs and leaves. Thus, while needing heartwood, seeking heartwood, wandering in search of heartwood, this person came to a great tree standing possessed of heartwood, and cutting off only its heartwood, he or she took it away, knowing it was heartwood. Whatever it was that this good man or woman had to make with heartwood, his or her purpose will be served. So too it is with this person who attains perpetual liberation." So, and then here's the summary paragraph at the end. This spiritual life, people, does not have gain, honor, and renown for its benefit, or the attainment of moral discipline for its benefit, or the attainment of concentration for its benefit, or knowledge and vision for its benefit. But it is this unshakable liberation of mind that is the goal of this spiritual life, its heartwood, and its end. I just think it's a great sutta. It's worth reading and just taking out that last paragraph and, you know, posting it somewhere. You know, you'll see it routinely. When we founded the little institute nonprofit, I wanted to call it Heartwood, but that term was so taken and sewed up, including by a massage school up in Ukiah, that we couldn't do it. But you can see, you know, why Heartwood is really the essence of it all. So what is it that helps us with this attainment of Heartwood? Many things do. Mindfulness is critically important. Mindfulness of many things, including the feeling tone that I've described. And one particular application of that I'd like to talk about tonight in terms of the desires that get us in trouble is the language of the Buddha with regard to the gratification, the danger, and the escape. So, for example, the brain has basically three fundamental motivational systems. As our ancestors evolved, literally several hundred million years ago, first they developed the avoid system, avoiding, stepping back, freezing, getting off the radar of predators. For example, flies that are still cannot be seen by a frog, even if the frog's eyeballs are just a couple inches away. If you freeze, you can't be seen. So that avoid system, or reaction to the unpleasant feeling tone, is deeply primal, which is, I think, a reason why the Buddha gave it so much attention. He really focused on reactions to the negative, to the unpleasant feeling tone, as major engines of suffering and harm. All right. Then comes this later system in the brain, particularly with the advent 200 or so million years ago of more complex creatures, certainly the reptiles, the early proto-reptiles, and then the dinosaurs, who could approach with more dexterity their goals, whether it was food or mating or, you know, different situations, approaching the pleasant, right? We have that system. And then there's the most recent system that came in with the evolution of birds and mammals, and then particularly primates and then really humans, the attaching system that bonds with us and draws on these two evolutionarily and neurologically lower systems, literally lower, of approaching and avoiding toward the ends of attaching. Okay? So each of these three systems can operate in either a mode of reactivity that's saturated with suffering and generative of suffering, or they can operate in a mode that I call the responsive mode. They're still engaged, but they're conducive of happiness and benefit for ourselves and for other people. So if you think about it, desires that get us into trouble, a useful way to think of them is in terms of these three categories. So for a moment, if you will, think of a desire that gets you into trouble, a goal or an approach to a goal, under the heading first of avoiding what's unpleasant. So you might think of some examples here. Ways, for example, that you back away from interactions with others that would actually be good for you and them to have, like telling the truth or addressing an issue or stepping into some necessary conflict, but you back away from them because they're uncomfortable. Or you know that it would be good for you to reach out to other people from the heart, to make more friends, to make more connections, you know, to go out in the world, but you anticipate it being unpleasant. Quick flag here, most feeling tones are anticipated, not actual, which is the key to freedom vis-a-vis them. If you realize the word in Pali for feeling tone is vedana, we have so many anticipatory vedanas in the inner simulator in the brain, where we're constantly imagining situations, what it would be like if I do this or don't do that, and so much of that anticipation happens within a second or two. You know, for example, we imagine, you know, speaking from the heart or reaching out to someone in a heartfelt and vulnerable way, and then within half a second there's the association from childhood that, whoa, that would be a really bad idea. And then another second or so comes the defense in psychological language that stops us from going there because we anticipate it being unpleasant. Right? Follow that? Okay. So think for a moment here about a desire that gets you into trouble, in a broad sense, related to this avoiding system, backing away from what's unpleasant. It could be a small thing, you know.
Most of us want to avoid rejection. That's what comes to mind.
Great. Thank you for saying that. Avoiding rejection, a very natural one. Avoiding bad news, like postponing getting into the checkbook, right? Or the IRS folder. Just, you know. Okay, great. Another system, the approaching system. You know, think about pleasures that get you into trouble. Eating. Drinking, overwork, just pursuing pleasant sensations in ways that get you in trouble. Like, yeah, okay. Can you get an example in your mind? Most of us have it. You know, the things we like too much and we get caught by. And then the last category, the attaching system, think about the realm of, you know, and again, these systems can overlap each other, of heartache, or pulling for narcissistic supplies, wanting praise, wanting to be special, in ways that are really a problem. They're more than just healthy, you know, reasonable desires to feel loved and cared for and appreciated.
That's a great phrase.
Which?
Narcissistic supplies.
Yeah, it's not my own, but it's a classic phrase, yeah. Okay, you get a sense. If you don't get a clear example, it's okay, but you get a sense of this. And this is a useful, I think, way to reflect and investigate yourself in terms of these three major areas, you know, avoiding what's unpleasant, pursuing what's pleasant in a fairly simple, kind of lower animal way, and then in a more sophisticated way, attaching to others, okay? And think about what's problematic in each one of those areas. And then in terms of that analysis, the Buddha, as I said a moment ago, talked about the gratification, the danger, and the escape. And that's a wonderful way to take a look at, and then in a moment I'll guide you through a little practice for actually working through a desire that gets you in trouble. So to read here this particular brief sutta, he says, before my enlightenment, while I was still Before my enlightenment, it occurred to me, what is the gratification in the world? What is the danger in the world? And what is the escape from the world? Then it occurred to me, whatever pleasure and joy there is in the world, this is the gratification in the world. That the world is impermanent, bound up with suffering, and subject to change, this is the danger in the world. The removal and abandoning of desire and lust for the world, that is the escape from the world. Now, this is someone talking who's a profound renunciate, who really has gone to the absolute end of relinquishing, you know, desire, who is still moved, of course, by wholesome inclinations. All right. So think to yourself, if you will, now let's do a little practice here and then we can talk a bit about it. Pick one of those desires, or pick a desire, maybe something that's currently an issue for you, that's getting you into trouble, or you feel frustration around this desire. Okay? So try to pick a desire. A wanting, a longing, particularly not something that feels really wholesome and it's just not being fulfilled these days, darn it, but rather something where you know there's something tangled or neurotic or messed up or problematic or muddy, troublesome in a desire. Okay? So first of all, think about the gratification in the desire. What is it that you hope to get from it? And what's it feel like? Take about half a minute here to be mindful of those gratifications in a big space of awareness with the background question in your mind, are they really that great? Admit to yourself what the deeper, sneakier, more primal, basement-level gratifications are, or that you hope to gain. While also being mindful of those gratifications and asking yourself, you know, when that desire is fulfilled, do those gratifications I hope for or anticipate or expect actually come true? And how long do they actually last? And then I'll move us on here, although you can go at your own pace. Now, with the same desire, reflect on the danger. Reflect on the costs to you in that desire. The collateral damage, the prices you pay, the impact on others. Reflect on how giving yourself over to that troublesome desire really takes you away from who you really are. You know, your heartwood self, your own inner heartwood. And then moving on to the third, the escape. Reflect on and open to what might help you release this desire or orient to it in a different way. And I'm going to suggest some possibilities here from the Buddha and my own observations. For one, just have insight into how rapidly everything changes. And even if the desire is fulfilled and has some gratifications, how quickly they pass away like sand, literally, in the hourglass, moving through your fingers. Rewards last, you know, how long does the taste last in the mouth of the world's greatest cookie, right? How long, literally, how long does an orgasm last, which is sort of the epitome of physical pleasure? Or if you do get some kind of sought-after praise from others or recognition, how long does the glow last, really? Another form of escape besides insight, which is the first one, essentially, is to simply not feed that particular desire, to not give it what the Buddha called the nutriments. So explore for a moment here what might be some ways to not feed that particular desire. Obvious examples are things like don't have cookies in the house, or don't keep alcohol in the home, or don't hang out with people who draw you into that desire. There are other more subtle forms of nutriment, though. For example, don't stress yourself so that you feel that you need to fulfill that desire as stress relief. No. What? Oh, like for example, oftentimes we're drawn to desires that get us in trouble as a reaction to feeling stressed, worn out, or just not centered. We're kind of fried. So it makes sense then to just watch a lot of TV or overeat or overdrink or oversex. Or also, another kind of desire, which we could talk more about, is the desire to just let it rip. And so when we get stressed and we're uncentered, it's a lot easier to give over to the desire to just be irritated with people or angry or snarky or short-tempered or quick, you know. A third way to practice with escape from desires that are getting us in trouble is distinct from not feeding the desire that's problematic, is feed other desires that are wholesome and healthy. You know, shift energy to the flowers in the garden of your mind. You have more fertilizer. So that's for things like coming regularly to a sitting group are really, really good. Having some kind of daily practice of some kind, a minute or more a day of some centering contemplative moment, it's a really good thing to do that feeds a different kind of desire. or surrounding yourself with good company, good people, or putting reminders near you, like that Heartwood Sutta paragraph near you. So what could you do to feed alternative desires to this problematic one? A variation on this one, which is feeding alternative desires, is to sense beneath the surface of the problematic desire to find what's wholesome in it. All right? That's a very interesting one. To use my cookie example, just because it's simplistic, you know, the desire for the third cookie, right? You know, what's underneath that? Well, maybe it's a desire for pleasure, or a desire for some kind of ease, or a desire to do something good for yourself in a life where there's just so much hard work and outflowing and putting up with conditions that are not great, and just, you know, soldiering on, right? And it's like, oh, I just want a nice moment. I just want something for me. You know, so many people were just outflowing. I want to take in. That's a wholesome desire. How could it be fulfilled in wiser ways than the third cookie? Especially when you know you need to lose a little weight. Okay. See? Or maybe there's, you know, the momentary desire to express anger toward people, you know, you live with or work with. Underneath that desire is probably something like, you know, experiencing flow or speaking the truth, or, you know, honoring your own needs in a situation, or just making a connection that's real, that cuts through so much of this phoniness and distancing between people, superficiality, whatever that might be. Well, then how could you feed those wholesome desires? This is a very effective way. Deep down, all desires are positive. You know, even Hannibal the cannibal had wholesome desires at root. He was trying to fill that hole in his heart in really problematic ways, like having friends over for dinner. And then the last one is, of course, to simply step out of the engine of desire altogether. You know, the state of relinquishment. That was the second talk I gave after I got back from retreat. Just relinquishment. It's a state we get to, particularly when we have a very, very strong sense of the evanescence of everything. How everything is just radically disappearing endlessly, and then somehow something else is happening. And in that, one increasingly just is outside of desire. I mean, the body still breathes. There is a desire in some basic sense for the next breath, and their movements toward goodness, but it just doesn't, throughout that process, there's a kind of fundamental surrender and a releasing and a renunciation. And I think a lot of us have tasted that, certainly, or are even deepening in it. And that's another very profound and just whoosh, unqualified, just complete way to escape from the danger that comes after the gratification of the desires that get us in trouble.
Are you talking about renunciation?
There I am. I mean, relinquishment is a state of, renunciation is more like a behavioral stance, which is great. Relinquishment is a traditional term. You know, I could see that you know that. You know, that's used when people are at that place where it's a natural, like, evolution where you increasingly just relinquish. It's not that you give up your own rights or needs, you know, or what you care about, but they're just kind of relinquished. I don't know how to say that.
Falling away.
Yeah, falling away. That's right.
Bend, bend,
abandoned. These are there are traditional terms that are used. They're falling away, relinquished. I, by the way, acknowledge the fact that I've gone late tonight and that I've really done this thing I keep telling myself to do less of, which is to just have a lot of content or meat, you know, with not many mashed potatoes, you know, a lot of meatballs, not many mashed potatoes. So how about we just take a few more minutes before we wrap tonight, and then next week let's really pick up on this theme, okay? Remember these three motivational systems, your fundamental intention perhaps around heartwood rather than twigs and leaves or bark, and then these key ideas of the gratification, the danger, and the escape. Okay, a few comments and then we'll wrap up. Yeah?
It seems to me there's layers or levels of suffering.
Yeah.
And you know, there's garden variety suffering, and then there's the kind of suffering that has become so overwhelming for a person.
Yeah.
For families.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
You know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, get up and have the gratitude, and you come across someone who perhaps is ill-tempered or whatever, and you can love them and bless them and go on, and then there are things that are so overwhelming that you can't even find your way. So maybe next week you can go over overwhelming suffering.
Yeah. I would say that that's incredibly important and, in a sense, different. You know, it's not related to this desire thing. But it's not at all trivial. It's just. I want to acknowledge that it's a distinct and important subject. But what arises sometimes is when we're. I've had times where I'm just completely caught in the undertow, and. For me, there's an absolute difference between being 100% just twirling down the drain into hell and being 99% twirling down the drain into hell, where even 1% or 1% of 1% of my awareness is aware of all this happening and distinct from it. And that's all the difference in the world. It reminds me of a teacher I had who said, this realm here will never be a heaven realm. With spiritual practice, which is the essence of that 1%, you know, that's able to disidentify from, and also good psychological practice that disidentifies from the utterness of the suffering and has some capacity to be aware of the suffering, to be the awareness of the suffering, not just the suffering. In other words, to have suffering, not just to be suffering. You see?
Yes.
That right there, this teacher said, makes this world at least a purgatory. But without that, it's a hell realm. Without that, it really is hell. We are just completely sucked in. Right? And I think that we do reap what we sow, for better or for worse. And the more minutes of real practice we have in our life, and the more we expose ourselves to community, good community, and good teachings, the more prepared we become for those times where the wave is overwhelming. It's overwhelming. And all we can do, honestly, is just last. And holding on to that little 1%. And that is all we can do, and magnificent. And deeply honorable. And the path of doing that is what makes this world, and those who do it, including everyone in this room, is what helps bit by bit make this world, if not heaven, not hell. So let's sit for a minute and then wrap, and next time I'll be more timely. letting yourself sink ever more deeply into your sense of the escape from the desires that get you into trouble. Increasingly getting on the other side of those desires. Feeling escape in your own body. Identifying increasingly with that way of being that has already escaped from the desires that get you into trouble. And may your own escape help free you and others from suffering and its causes. Thank you for your practice.